Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Now that we know what's in the Senate health care bill, what does it actually mean? Not on the Washington political level, but on the everyman, am I covered or not, and how much is it going to cost me level? That story on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 19th of November today. Good to have you with us. We have known the broad outlines of the Senate's health care bill for a while now, but we figured now that we have the specifics, it was officially released last night, it might be good to figure out what consumers are going to get for the bill's $849 billion price tag. What'll it do for your average family of four with no insurance? That was today's assignment for Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
So, we've got a fictional family of four with no insurance. We'll put 45-year-old George at the head of the family. He works at a restaurant. Let's say he earns $66,000 a year. George had a heart attack a few years ago. To get an idea of how his family would fare under the health care overhaul, I called the Center for American Progress. Ellen Marie Whalen is the center's associate director of health policy. She used an online benefits calculator to crunch the numbers for George and his fictional family.
And he works in a restaurant, and let's say he works in a restaurant that has less than 50 employees. And we're going to put that he has to purchase his own insurance because his employer has not chosen to offer him health insurance.
By Whalen's calculations, George would be able to insure his family for $15,000 a year under the health care overhaul proposals. The government would pay almost half of that, leaving George with a bill of about $6,300. Where would George buy his insurance? Because of his income and the fact that his employer doesn't insure him, George can shop for a policy in an insurance exchange. Elizabeth McGlenn of the RAND Corporation explains how the exchange works. She says there'll be a website to log on to.
So people could go on and compare the different plans that are being offered in their state. They'll all have standard benefit packages, so it'll be easier than it often is today to know what you're getting from the different health insurance companies who are offering the policies.
But what if George decides not to buy insurance? Whalen says he would pay a fine under the Senate plan.
So he'd have to pay $285 the first year. And that quickly goes up in a couple years to $750 per person, half for kids.
George's employer wouldn't be fined because his restaurant has fewer than 50 workers. Sarah Collins is an economist with the Commonwealth Fund. She says our fictional family is pretty typical of today's uninsured.
Right now, if you don't have coverage through an employer, there's really very little place. There are few places for you to turn to except the individual insurance market. And if you've had a heart attack or pre-existing health or have other pre-existing health conditions, it's really tough to get an affordable policy or maybe not a policy at all.
It's not clear when our fictional family can get their insurance. The debate over the legislation is likely to drag into next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The more you read a 2,000-page piece of legislation, the more you learn. Like this tidbit, there is a 5% tax in there on optional cosmetics procedures, stuff like Botox treatments and nose jobs and tummy tucks. The proceeds are supposed to raise almost $6 billion over the next decade to help pay for health care reform. But as you might imagine, plastic surgeons have their knives out for this idea. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Leading plastic surgeons we spoke to today sought to shed the glamorous image their profession gets from Hollywood on shows like Nip Tuck.
Since 1987, the one luxury business that has always seen annual growth has been plastic surgery.
Contrary to popular belief, cosmetic surgery is not longer an exclusive luxury for the wealthy.
Salt Lake City plastic surgeon Renato Saltz is head of the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery. He says the Senate plan would unfairly target patients who already pay full price. Cosmetic procedures aren't covered by insurance.
Over 80% of our patients are really middle class. We feel that a tax like this would discriminate against women. 86% of total cosmetic surgeries performed on women.
At the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, Seattle-based president-elect Dr. Phil Hake says now isn't the time to single out those who see a need for his services.
I have had any number of patients come through lately and said, just lost my job. I haven't had to go out and apply for a job for 10 years. I want to look a little better. Should we penalize that patient with an additional 5% tax? I don't think so.
Hake doubts the measure will raise the billions lawmakers expect, especially since members of his organization have been reporting their businesses off as much as 30% this year. He also says distinguishing between what's optional and what's necessary reconstructive surgery would be very tricky in many cases. Plastic surgeons argue their procedures aren't any more frivolous than laser eye surgery or other popular medical procedures that wouldn't be taxed. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders could have used a bit of a lift. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. News of this morning's glitch in the air traffic control system would have been unwelcome any time. Coming as it did just before one of the busiest travel weeks of the year, it was a reminder of the limitations of our current system of getting planes from one place to the other. For more on what happened and what the future might bring, we have reached aviation consultant Hans Weber in San Diego. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We should say at the front, sir, that you have done some consulting work with the FAA over the years, yes?
Yeah, that's correct, but not on air traffic management, but on aircraft safety.
That being the case, why does it feel like these outages, this is the second one in 15 months, why does it feel like this keeps happening?
Many of these system components go back to the 50s. This particular component that looks like it failed is a newer one that goes back to just a few years ago, but it interfaces with a lot of old systems. You know, and as old systems get old, they become less reliable. One major problem is for many of the old systems, the replacement and repair components are not necessarily easily available anymore. They're out of production.
Well, then what does that say for our ability to prevent this from happening again? Do we have to replace the whole architecture, the whole infrastructure?
That's the goal. We have a plan in this country to replace the entire system with a new one.
How do we go about speeding up that replacement? Is it just a matter of getting more, bigger, faster computers and slapping them into a rack someplace?
No, it's a matter of implementing a completely different architecture. The current system is basically ground-based. Ground-based radar keeps track of airplanes, which is not very accurate, so the airplanes have to be spaced far apart. And the controllers control every move of each airplane. There's no autonomy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The future system is satellite-based. Every airplane will use a GPS receiver and will broadcast down to the ground information about its exact location, which is going to be 10 to 20 times more accurate than the current radar location information. And that information will be received at ground stations, and then from there will go to the air traffic controllers. This kind of system will not only tell the air traffic controllers with much greater accuracy where all aircraft are, but in addition, aircraft will receive this information from other aircraft in the vicinity. So each aircraft itself will have a display of what's going on around it. So that will, in fact, provide pilots more autonomy to select the most efficient flight patterns.
What do you suppose the price tag might be for this system?
Yeah, the government-supplied infrastructure, the tag is estimated at about $20 billion. And then the other part, which is the equipage on aircraft or the necessary avionics instrumentation on aircraft mm-hmm. to receive these signals and transmit the signals, that is estimated to cost like another $20 billion roughly.
If we don't get it done by 2020 or even shortly before, what's at risk? What happens?
We will suffer more and more economic damage. We will be going back to 2000, where the air traffic system began to be overloaded, and we had significant delays in the system. Plus, these delays will get worse. Plus, we will be suffering bad economic consequences in our competition worldwide. Our aviation industry has historically benefited from the fact that the FAA has basically set the standards for the whole world. And our aviation industry was always the first to market with new avionics equipment. So as we lose that lead, our industry is going to lose that ability to command a higher profit margin for newly introduced, newly deployed technology.
Hans Weber in San Diego, California. He's the president of TCOP International. It's an aviation consulting firm. Mr. Weber, thanks so much for your time.
You're most welcome.
The most heavily traded futures contract in New York today was not oil. It wasn't gold. You'll probably never guess, so I'll just go ahead and give you the answer. Sugar was the hot commodity today as traders backed it down off 28-year highs. Rumors of a big purchase by the Indian government helped drive that. Here in this country, more than half of our sugar comes from beets, from a beet crop that is almost entirely genetically modified. Organic farmers and food safety advocates are suing to keep that crop out of the ground this coming spring. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
If the Midwest is the nation's breadbasket, then Oregon's Willamette Valley might be called its seed basket.
The Willamette Valley is a world-class place to grow seeds. We have good soils, ample water, but really, it is the climate. It's a dry summer and a mild, moist winter.
Frank Morton came here as a young man from West Virginia and quickly got into farming. He now runs Wild Garden Seed, which produces 150 varieties of organic seeds. He showed me around his drying shed, piled high with escarole, peppers, and table beets.
My workers are over here sowing seed flats with my bull's blood beet, my Gregor's beet.
Morton's organic seed farm is tiny, 5 acres and a greenhouse. There are 5,000 acres of commercial sugar beet seed planted across this valley. Nationwide, sugar beets are a $3 billion crop. And nearly all of those beets are genetically engineered to resist an herbicide called Roundup. It's made by Monsanto, and when it's used on Roundup-ready plants like corn, alfalfa, and sugar beets, it kills all the weeds in a field. But crops are left unharmed because they have a gene that makes them immune. And therein lies the problem for Frank Morton.
Actually, a mile and a quarter east of here is a sugar beet seed farm. I'm upwind of that guy, but not exactly upwind of him.
That wind could carry genetically engineered sugar beet pollen into Morton's organic farm and contaminate his crop.
If biotech traits show up in my seeds, then my seeds are worthless. If my traits show up in conventional or biotech seeds, it's not a big deal to them. It does not destroy their value. It's an asymmetrical relationship we have here.
Organic growers have raised similar concerns about genetically engineered soybeans, corn, and other crops. This time, they're looking to tip the balance back. They spearheaded a lawsuit charging the USDA approved Roundup-ready sugar beets without assessing potential environmental impacts, like genetic contamination and herbicide resistance. In September, a federal judge ordered the USDA to do the environmental review. It could take years. In the meantime, the farmers and their allies are headed back to court. Zelig Golden is a lawyer with the Center for Food Safety.
We're going to be moving the court to issue a permanent injunction to halt the sale and planting of GE sugar beet seeds now and into the future until the USDA does its job to protect consumers and farmers alike.
That would help the organic farmers, but there are 10,000 non-organic farmers raising more than 1 million acres of Roundup-ready sugar beets in 11 states. Along with Monsanto and the big seed companies, farmers are trying to protect their multi-billion-dollar business from a planting ban next spring. Monsanto, which has the patent for Roundup Ready seeds, wouldn't comment for this story, citing the pending litigation. Luther Marquardt of the American Sugar Beet Growers Association says more is at stake than the revenue from next year's crop.
This is a food security issue. We need to make sure that we have a good, strong, viable domestic beet sugar industry.
And he says the environmentalists have this one all wrong.
What you find with Roundup is you use one herbicide. You can apply it typically half as often. So this is a much more environmentally friendly way of raising our crop.
Mark Wirt says 95% of the crop nationwide has converted to Roundup Ready in just the past 3 years, and he insists organic growers can be protected using traditional methods like monitoring and isolation. Frank Morton says just one accident could ruin him. The parties meet in court next month. In a similar case, a judge banned Roundup Ready alfalfa. Monsanto's appealing that decision to the Supreme Court. If there's a ban on sugar beet planting nationwide, it's doubtful there's enough conventional seed in storage to lay in a crop next spring. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, looking south to solve North America's green power problem.
Here in Baja California, we have a, let's say, a surplus of renewable energy potential, and we can't consume all that power.
But first, let's do the numbers. Technology stocks led the market lower today, helping sink the Dow Industrials 93 points, not quite 1%. The blue chip index closed at 10,332. The tech-heavy NASDAQ took it on the chin, dropping 36 points, 1 2/3%, finished at 2156. The S&P 500 carved off 14 points, 1 1/3%, wrapped up at 1,094. An analyst report sounded an alarm over a rising glut of semiconductor chips, and that came with a downgrade that hurt stocks across the tech sector. Intel down 4%, Texas Instruments down just over 3%, shares of iPod and iPhone maker Apple peeled off more than 2.5%. The greenback, the dollar, gained some strength today, but that put downward pressure on commodity shares. Alcoa stock sheared off almost 4%. Today, U.S. Steel Corp. filed off a little over 3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Our icon on your iPhone. The Marketplace app gives you the latest in business news, plus the Marketplace whiteboards and the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Association for the Education of Young Children continues its annual conference in Washington. If movies are your thing, you've probably heard that the Twilight Saga New Moon hits theaters. And happy birthday, Mr. Vice President. Joe Biden turns 67. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There was a point back in the thick of the financial crisis where we had all heard more than we wanted to about some of those fancy financial products, things like auction rate securities and collateralized debt obligations. Private investors weren't the only ones who were seduced by them, though. Plenty of school districts and municipal governments got involved with things known as interest rate swaps. They were supposed to provide a hedge against big changes in interest rates. But borrowers from Harvard University to Jefferson County, Alabama, lost billions of dollars on them. And now a Pennsylvania official wants to ban them altogether, as Joel Rose reports.
The school district in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, tried to use interest rate swaps to lower the cost of borrowing for its building projects. But those bets backfired because interest rates dropped, and the district wound up owing investment banks more than $10 million.
It's almost as if the school district took public money and went and gambled that public money at a casino.
Pennsylvania Auditor General Jack Wagner says hundreds of schools and local governments in the state made similar bets. He wants to see those deals terminated and a ban on interest rate swaps. Tennessee has already passed far-reaching restrictions, and other states are considering regulation too. Robert Doty advises state and local governments on financial securities.
The municipal bond market is littered with bodies of local governments that have had to pay enormous amounts to terminate their swaps. They didn't understand the risks. They thought nothing could go wrong. They found out otherwise.
But not everyone agrees that a total ban is the answer. David DeVar is research director for the Pennsylvania School Boards Association.
There are some districts that have done these successfully. They haven't all gone bad.
Instead of a ban, DeVar says he'd like to see more enforcement of Pennsylvania's current law, especially the part that requires school districts to hire independent financial advisors. He says too many advisors had an incentive to steer their clients into risky deals. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Negotiators are trying to figure out what is exactly going to get done at next month's climate change meeting in Copenhagen. The global economy, though, waits for no one, and a lot of countries have already started trying to capitalize on their green industries. That has been the subject of our series, The Climate Race, this week. Today, how Mexico is trying to build its low-carbon economy. Sam Eaton reports now from Baja.
The tiny Mexican border town La Rumorosa got its name from the sound the wind makes as it whips across the area's rock-strewn ridges. But today, La Rumorosa's centuries-old name is taking on new meaning. That's the sound of 300-foot-tall wind turbines the Baja government just installed here. Their giant spinning blades are the first to tap into what's considered the most consistent winds in all of North America. And if David Munoz with Baja California's Energy Commission has his way, these five turbines are only the beginning.
What this project means is that the state government is putting an example to, take a look at Baja California and, see that the wind does really blow and there's a huge potential to, grasp that resource and turn it into something productive.
And something profitable. The electricity from these turbines will be used in Baja's capital city, Mexicali. But Munoz says that's only a fraction of what's possible. Experts say there's enough wind here to power millions of homes.
Here in Baja California, we have a surplus of renewable energy potential. And we can't consume all that power.
Just to the north, however, California can't get enough. It's experiencing a shortage as it tries to get 20% of its electricity from sources other than natural gas and coal. Munoz says Mexico would be happy to fill that gap and earn a profit doing it. It just needs the capital to make it happen.
If we really want to, make these big projects and displace a huge amounts of greenhouse gases and produce a lot of energy and so on and so forth, what we need is private players who come in and share the risk and share the investment.
And help Mexico get a foothold in a new global economy that's less dependent on fossil fuels. Today, oil accounts for nearly half of the Mexican government's annual revenues, and an increasing number of politicians here see that as a vulnerability. One of them is Baja's governor, José Guadalupe Osuna Millán.
The key is diversification. We see less developed countries can not only gain extraordinary benefits economically, but also with regards to sustainability.
Multinational energy companies also see a chance to profit in Mexico. Several, including U.S.-based Sempra Energy and Spain's Union Fenosa, have already gotten permits to develop huge wind farms near La Rumorosa. Tom Houston is a lawyer who puts these kinds of deals together, and he says they offer a sort of test case for how rich and poor nations can collaborate.
In working out the issues on how you get wind power from Mexico into California, you're working out on a micro scale what has to be worked out worldwide on a macro scale.
One of the major sticking points holding up a new international climate treaty is whether rich countries should pay poor ones to fight the global warming they essentially caused by burning oil and coal. And if so, how would it be done? One option is to create a new global climate fund. But Houston says in countries like Mexico, where corruption is rampant, that could be a disaster.
Government funding does not work, period. There's a disappearance of money. For whatever reason, it never ends up getting spent on the project it's supposed to be spent in.
Houston says direct foreign investment, on the other hand, yields far greater results much faster. And there's good reason for that. Al Swedler directs the Center for Energy Studies at San Diego State University.
The bottom line is it has to be driven by self-interest. Unless people think there's something in it for them,
they can say all the nice words, but nothing's going to happen. And what we've learned here is that it's a benefit for us to have this energy relationship with Mexico, and it's a benefit for them.
Especially for Baja, which is struggling with drought and high unemployment. Last week in Tecate, Mexico, Sempra Energy held a public hearing on a proposed wind farm north of La Rumorosa. Once completed, it could supply enough energy to power more than 300,000 homes in the U.S. and create hundreds of Mexican jobs. According to a group of local ranchers gathered outside, that foreign investment is critical. 56-year-old Tezo Duques has raised cattle in the nearby Sierra de Juarez Mountains his entire life. But he says in the last few years, the annual rains they've depended on for generations have stopped coming.
It's very serious. Before in the Sierra de Juarez, we used to have maybe 10,000 cows, and now there aren't even 500. Our way of life is ending. A lot of people have had to go into town to work. The ranches are being abandoned.
Sempra is offering to pay local ranchers $500 a month to put dozens of turbines on their land. Duque's neighbor, Orsilio Gandalfe Altamirano, says it's no fortune, but it's enough to keep them in business.
The Americans are the rich business partners. We're the poor ones. But we need them. It's about time the two regions were united. We have the things they don't have, but they have the money. They've always had the money, the bastards.
Altamirano says a border fence may divide Baja from the United States, but when it comes to climate change, political boundaries no longer matter. In Baja, Mexico, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The archives of this week's climate coverage and of the first installment of the climate race from a couple of weeks ago, they're all on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we send you on your way. Back a year ago, when the market really started going south, you heard a lot of financial advisors say the best thing to do was nothing. Sit tight and wait it out. Today, from Fidelity Investments comes confirmation of the soundness of that strategy. Fidelity says its account holders with a good mix of stocks and bonds in their 401ks are back in positive territory. Not by much, mind you. Once you take out employer and personal contributions, the one-year rate of return was 0.4%. But when you think about where a lot of us were back at the market lows in March, 30-40% down, 0.4 up, really, not so bad. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow lost 93 points, almost 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 36 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 down 14 points, 1.3%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, who makes money when vampires come to town? There's that movie coming out, you know. And next time on this broadcast, tomorrow afternoon, why thrift stores are suddenly all the rage.
This recession, because it's been so cataclysmic, it's exposed more people to the thrift shop that perhaps hadn't even thought about it before.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.